The outro music didn't play. Awesome.
That's all right. You can put it in post.
Yeah, I'll put it in post. If you're watching the YouTube, then I guess you just have to imagine it going on right now. Hello and welcome to the Ritual Misery Podcast, episode beta 46 for Wednesday, the 26th of August, 2015. This is a show where two lifelong friends talk about geek stuff and whatever else comes to mind. I'm Amos, and that dude right there is still with the fuzzy stuff on his face. That's Ken. How you doing,
man? Hey, how's it going?
It's been a week.
It's been
very exciting.
It certainly has been a week.
The old man up north decided to start playing around a little bit, and it's Korea, so.
Right, yeah, that happens from time to time.
It does. So last week I podcasted in the middle of a lot of ramp up and a whole bunch of rhetoric. This week I'm podcasting in the middle of a bunch of knee-jerk reactions that don't really mean a whole lot, so kind of a different situation.
Yeah, that's kind of how it goes. I was in Korea, what's it been now, 6-7 years ago? And yeah, it's one of those things. It just kind of, it seems like every few months something like this happens. So
yeah,
just part of life over there.
Yeah, it's still technically at war, but nobody actually wants to escalate it. It's kind of a funny situation. So, hey man, guess what?
What's up?
Well, see, you send out an email to a particular person that we've been fans of for quite a while, and she responded.
Yeah, she sure did.
And now she's on our show. Miss Margaret Weis, the best-selling fantasy and science fiction writer and one of the original creators of the Dragonlance fantasy setting. Good morning. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
We are doing well. This has been it's kind of a dream come true, Miss Weis, I have to admit.
Oh, thank you.
So we started reading the Dragonlance novels when we were, 13 years old, something like that.
Eighth grade.
Yeah, 13, 14 years old. And we grew up with it. It's been such a big influence on us, not only turning, at least me anyway, turning me into a fan of the fantasy genre, but really got me interested in just reading. And that in turn like made me a lifelong learner. So for that, I thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. That's good to hear.
Now I'm kind of the cynic on board, so I know you've heard that from quite a few of your fans about how much they really enjoyed it. Has anyone ever come to you and said, "Hey, you shouldn't have written those books"?
Let's see. Actually, one guy came up to me and asked me if I knew how many people I'd killed over the years.
Oh, geez.
A little scary. I don't think he'd taken his medication that day.
Yeah, right.
Wow, that's not at all the answer I was expecting on that. That's awesome.
No, I think George R. R. Martin has you beat, though.
Yeah. I don't know.
Tracy and I dropped a rock on a whole world. So
yeah.
Well, that is true.
Yeah, and if you just talking about Kryn, if you want to talk the Cataclysm itself. That's quite a few people right there. I don't think George R. R. Martin's done that, the apocalyptic scenario. So, but we wanted to bring you on. We love doing geek stuff on the show. We've had some guests on that have been. We have Mikhail Abdullah, who's an MMA fighter and closet geek. Like it's just amazing. So. One of the things that Kent and I learned by prepping for you to come on our show was that you you love your dogs.
Oh yeah, I do fly racing.
Yeah, and I never heard of fly ball racing until your email. So, what is that all about?
Yeah, tell us about fly ball and the Barkbarians in particular.
Flyball racing is like a relay race for dogs. You have four dogs on a team. You race against another team of dogs. And first dogs run over a series of four hurdles. They hit a spring-loaded box, catch a tennis ball. Second dog passes the first, and whichever team is fastest wins.
Wow. That sounds really exciting.
I don't think my dog Sam would dig that at all.
Yeah, I don't think my dogs would be into that.
You must have some patience to have that going on with your dogs and everything else. That sounds awesome.
It is. It's a lot of fun. And you get to spend the weekend with dog people, and you eat junk food and, you know, mess with your dogs. It's really, really great.
Sounds like a dog lover's version of D&D weekends. That's all I'm saying.
Right.
Is there warm Mountain Dew on the side? Because that's required for anything like that.
Yeah.
Cold pizza.
Cold pizza and warm Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
So,
boys.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Amos. Oh, I was just going to say, I heard that you're going to Dragon Con this year.
Yes. First time in many years I'm going back. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
This of all years, that's just one more reason me and Kent want to go to Dragon Con, and unfortunately can't.
Right.
It's crazy.
we've never actually been to a big con other than South by Southwest, so that's not really a con. It's more of a...
That's pretty big. I mean, it's getting big.
It really is. It's a lot of fun, though. It's especially for for people that still like to abuse their livers. South by Southwest is a lot of fun. A lot of tech stuff, a lot of games. Because just being surrounded by 10,000 geeks in the middle of a great city is awesome.
Yeah, for sure. So are you going to Dragon Con as a representative of Margaret Weiss Productions, or just kind of going as yourself, or what are you
going
to be doing?
I'm going as myself. Yeah, I just, because Margaret Weiss Productions, we have a pretty big presence at Gen Con. We have a booth, and, you know, I'm pretty well stuck at the booth all day. And Dragon Con, I actually get to, I don't have to be in the booth. I get to go to seminars and get to walk around the dealer room. And
you get to fangirl out.
I do. I really do.
Yeah. Awesome.
Very cool. How often do you get recognized when you're, you know, just out and about at conventions like that?
Well, I, you know, like in Gen Con, I figure I'm probably one of the oldest people there. So people usually know me. Oh, that's Margaret Weiss. You know, she's been around for 30 years.
You're going to Gen Con for 30 years at that.
Yeah. 31 that's, this year. 31 years.
Oh, wow. And is that consecutive, or is that, you know, 31 years total?
Yes, consecutive. Oh. Yeah. My first one was in 1983.
That makes you a staple. Like, if you don't go, something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't have it, you know.
No, yeah. No, Gen Con this year. Margaret's not feeling well.
Do you know, is Tracy going to be at Dragon Con this year?
I don't know. I haven't talked to him. I know he went last year, and that he's recovering from his youngest daughter's wedding. So, So I'm not sure if he's going to make it this year or not.
I like that. Recovering from his youngest daughter's wedding. I like that.
Right.
There's so many ways that you could mean that.
Right.
So when you're... I'm having a hard time formulating the questions in my mind because they're all coming to me so quickly. We should have written these down, dude. Oh, wait, you did. So
yeah, I did.
when you're at conventions, what is the biggest draw for you as a writer? Is it meeting the people? Is it sources of creativity or seeing what other people are doing? Is it just the fan aspect of it?
Meeting people. Yeah, it's meeting people. I really enjoy meeting people and talking to them. And this year it's going to be kind of special because Filmscope Entertainment is doing a movie with Star of the Guardians. And we're actually having kind of a press party, fan party, high tea on Friday morning. So that's going to be fun. I've never done anything like that before. So I'm always, you know, looking for new experiences and new people to meet.
Very so cool. what is that like to have one of your works being turned into a movie?
It's just, you know, it's really amazing because, you know, I think every author at the back of his or her mind, probably starting with Shakespeare, you want to see your work, or before, you want to see your works brought to life.
Sure.
So this has really been a lot of fun, especially because I've gotten to work so closely with the studio. I've gotten help with the script, and it's been really a neat experience. They're based in Australia, and so it's just it's been so much fun.
Cool.
Speaking of movies and having your things turned into movies, getting back to Dragonless a little bit here. Dragons of Autumn Twilight was turned into a movie, an animated movie.
Yeah.
Because I have a different opinion on the movie than Kent does. What is your opinion of the movie, of the final product?
The music was good.
I also thought the music was pretty good, and I really enjoyed a lot of the voice talent.
Kiefer Sutherland was tremendous.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of my high points. I personally really enjoyed it. I think they left out a few key things in it that I would like to have seen more of, and they didn't interpret things the same way that I would have. But that's the case with any kind of written work, I think. But overall, I enjoyed it. It wasn't the live action movie I was always dreaming of, but it satiated the need for it for a while.
So is there any new word or any more recent word on the possibility of a live action Dragonlance movie?
If there is, Wizards of the Coast doesn't tell me.
Oh, jeez.
You know, they're not my tracking. They really don't tell me.
Yeah. Oh, gee. Oh.
How much liberty do you have on the current creative scenario of not only Dragonlance, but of the other worlds that you've assisted with TSR and thus Wizards of the Coast?
They own all the rights.
So it's like, do they consult you on things, or is it just kind of in their pocket and they do what they want?
No, they used to. They used to back in the day, but pretty much not anymore.
That's so sad.
Well, of course, they're not publishing Dragonlance anymore. So
this is true.
Right.
Reprinting some of the old books and not all of those. So.
Wow. So Dragonlance is sitting on 30 years old. Now, forgive my naivete here, but was Dragonlance the first world that you created in such an aspect, in such an important role?
It was the first world I had published, or the first novels I had published, but I had written before that. And in fact, I had written the Star of the Guardian books ahead of that, even before I came to TSR. And they've gotten rejected. In fact, Susan Allison, who's now vice president with ACE, she was an editor then and sent me my first really good rejection letter. All writers know what that means. But anyway, so then when I went to TSR, I met Tracy and heard the Dragonlance story and fell in love with it and just kind of went from there. The whole thing was very complicated and serendipitous. And
kind of landed in the right laps at the right time, huh?
Absolutely, yeah.
How much of a no? Tracy, he created the world. The story is that he was on his way to TSR for a job interview, and they said come up with something, and he started writing or started naming off things as Laura was writing them down in the car on the way there. Now, how much did he actually have? Did he have a full finished product, or were when you got into the fold of things, was it a creative collaboration, or did he just say, here's what it is, and you just went and wrote something about it?
He was in charge of the design team that was working on the game side of things. So by the time I got there, they had the whole world developed, and they had a plot, because Dragonlance was the first role-playing game that TSR published that actually had a story. an overarching storyline that connected all the modules together. It wasn't, you know,
Greyhawk.
Like Tracy used to say, Dragon of the Month Club, you know.
Right.
Find the dragon, kill the dragon, get the treasure. Next month, find the dragon, kill the dragon, get the treasure. he wanted the heroes to have a more noble purpose. And so by the time I got there, they had this plot that extended over 12 modules. And that, you know, that conceivably you could play the game for a year. And my job, I was hired on as a book editor, was to take this huge plot and distill it down to go into a novel. And so that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, they had all the game side of stuff. My job was to take the characters, and they had all the stats and everything else, but I had to create backgrounds for them. And in fact, that's what led me to Raceland, was I knew he was a third level wizard. I knew he had this big hunk of a brother, Caramon, that they were twins, but that Raceland didn't look anything like Caramon. He had golden skin and hourglass eyes. So I asked, why does he have golden skin and hourglass eyes? And Larry Elmore said, well, because it looks good. So I find the reason.
That sounds like an artist interpretation of any reasoning, because that's I drew it and it looked cool.
So I had to find a reason. And so I thought, well, it must have something to do with his magic. And what if he had to pass a test for magic users, which makes sense because magic is very powerful. And they just wouldn't want to unleash amateur magicians on the world. And so then what if, in order, if you flunked this test, what if you had to pay with your life? And how would his undoubtedly overprotective twin brother feel about that? And then that led me to the whole Raceland Caramon storyline and their relationship, and just went from there.
So what you're telling me right now is that you designated, if not designed, the specific aspects of the test of high sorcery.
Yeah.
Oh, you just became my favorite game designer as well now. See, that's how playing in the Dragonlance Saga, that was always one of the things that I really, really loved about how magic was structured and how it was controlled. And, it was so impactful that they had a test, that the test failure meant death and success didn't always mean walking away scot-free. And, you know, that was always one of the things that endeared me as a constant magic user player.
Well, yeah, because, you know, wizards must sacrifice. Even wizards must sacrifice. Otherwise, if they're too powerful, they become boring as a character.
Right. So... like, why is tonight the night my throat is deciding to?
you know, Amos, this kind of got me thinking of one of our earliest Dungeons and Dragons outings together. You were the DM, and I was playing a magic user. And one of the first things that you had me do was to prepare for the test.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, you wanted to play the magic user, and I warned everybody else away from it. Because in Dragonlance, magic is intentionally sparse.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But everybody wanted to play magic user because everybody wanted to be Raceland. And I kind of
yeah.
go through the test. And I believe three people went through it. Only you passed. Yeah. So
you know, this brings me to something else, Margaret. There's a persistent myth that I think has been dispelled, but if you could clear it up for us. People have been saying for years that the Dragonlance stories came out of playtesting of the campaign setting with you and Tracy and several other people playtesting. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, no, it was... You really couldn't do that because gaming sessions don't translate well into novels. And they really didn't have time at that time to sit around and play test all the modules. There were a couple of play tests when it first started, one of which ended very badly. And if we used that, the books would have ended in Zach Saros because everybody died.
Oh, wow.
So, I think I only ever playtested once or twice. Now, Bapu, the character Bapu, came out of a playtest session. Because and Raceland's talking in kind of whispering voice, because I noticed whenever the player, who was Terry Phillips, did that, everybody in the party immediately shut up to hear what he had to say. And I thought, well, of course Raceland would use that, you know, whether he needed to or not, because it was attention getting. And then it was in that playtest session that Raceland had cast a charm spell on the Scully Dwarf. We were in Zach Saros. And Tracy had the Golly Dwarf fall in love with him and follow him around all the time and hang on to his robe. And, you know, and she said, I'm going to, you know, take you home to mother. And it was really funny to see how Raceland had to kind of cope with this. And so that definitely made it into the book.
Yeah, that was one of those endearing aspects when it actually sparked a little bit of debate, because we were all kind of reading the books at the same time. And for the charm spell to have taken hold in such a fashion, we had an open debate amongst us whether the charm spell just didn't wear off or if Bapu actually genuinely fell in love with Raceland. And, you know, that was one of those things that we had to reread a couple times just to capture it all and how much Raceland actually felt for Bapu and things like that. And that was one of those little dichotomies in the middle of the book that I didn't expect to see nor – like have such a feeling for. So that was great.
Yeah. Thank you. But you have to understand too, at the time, that I really didn't know anything about D&D. I mean, to this day, somebody always has to tell me what dice to roll. And pretty much if I wanted, however I wanted the spell to work, I made it work.
Right. That's the same way with Kent. He can never remember what die to roll either.
Right. Yeah. I'm not particularly good at that.
which one do I roll? The D10. Which one is that?
Yeah. I know. I do that all the time.
So throughout like fantasy, I've always kind of thought that halfling characters were kind of boring, I guess. Not very interesting to me. But Kinder, being sort of a halfling race, I find Kinder fascinating. Who came up with that race? Was that Tracy or was that you?
It was kind of a combination of lots of people. They needed a halfling race for Dragonlance, but they didn't want to use halflings because, of course, they were a little bit leery about copyright, you know, whether they could use halflings or not. So they came up, Harold Johnson was the one who suggested Kinder. He wanted as a race of thieves. But Tracy objected to that on moral grounds. So he said, what if Kinder stole not out of greed, but out of curiosity? Just more like a race of kleptomaniacs.
Right, yeah.
and then Roger Moore was the first one to write a short story featuring Tasselhoff. And so he was the one who set Tasselhoff's character. And then when I included Tasselhoff in the novels, I took what Roger did and went on with it.
Wow. Speaking of Kinder, if you have any insight on this, when I first read, when the Grey Gem was disclosed and the history of the Grey Gem and how it went around and changed everybody and you know, the big big sundering of Kryn races, I always wondered if the Grey Gem was always in the plan or was it something just to describe it later, you know, ex post facto? Was there a grand plan?
Yeah, the Grey Gem was one of the original concepts of the design team for how the lesser races, as they were called, came about.
And that is so awesome, because that's exactly what I was always hoping, because to be able to tie things together that way. Of course, the three original races were the ogres, the humans, and the elves, and having everything come right from there. Well, and the dragons, of course. But, mm-hmm. So that's just amazing. Now, While you were writing the Dragonlance saga, the Chronicles in particular, because that's kind of where really caught hold. How much creative freedom did you have with Tracy on how things were going to go? Was it a matter of you wrote it and then he okayed it, or was it just kind of, hey, I've got an idea, and he was like, sure, do whatever?
Yeah, we worked out the plot along with our game editor Michael Williams, who was also our poet. And so we would meet and we would work out the plot. And at the time, again, we were working under an immensely weird deadline because they had originally hired this other author and then he didn't work out. So they fired him, but Tracy and I had to meet the same deadline. So we had our day jobs. So I would write at night and on the weekends, and then I would give Tracy what I had written, and he would go through and make notes and read it and then give it back to me. And then it went to our editor. So it was pretty crazy.
Wow. Well, and did you write all three of them at the same time, like, in consecutive order? Were you still working on the first one when you started working on the second one, or was it a complete, okay, here's volume one, here's volume two?
We wrote, because TSR didn't think they were going to sell, for one thing, because nobody had ever heard of Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. Random House was our distributor, and Random House told them, you have these two people nobody's ever heard of. This book isn't going to sell. So instead of a trilogy, management came to us and said, it's only going to be one book. That's why Autumn Twilight has the ending where Riverwind and Goldmoon get married, because that wasn't supposed to happen in the outline until after they'd been to the Dwarven Kingdom. So we had to completely scrap, and the Dwarven Kingdom was also supposed to have been in the first book. So that got cut, along with lots of other stuff, because TSR said it could only be a certain number of pages and only sell, because they only wanted to sell it for $2.95, because they didn't think it was going to sell. So that's what we did. We were just hoping it sold enough that we would get to do a second volume, but we had no idea whether we were going to or not.
Wow. That things like this shed a whole different light on the whole story about how things match up. And in between each of the volumes, one to two to three, there are large gaps in time that are basically filled in with poetry.
And then that's why we went back and wrote the Lost Chronicles several years ago. And of course, one thing I would love to do, Tracy and I have talked about it, is to go back and do Dragonlance Chronicles as it was originally envisioned, with everything added back in that was cut out.
Right. That would blow me away. I've got the Annotated Chronicles and the Annotated Legends, actually. And one of my favorite things was, as I was rereading it the last time, which I don't know how many times I've read them, but the last time I reread them, I read them with the little notes and the liners and everything else. And it was amazing to see some of the backstory on things, but I knew there was so much more there, and things that had gotten cut and little notes that you had made on the side saying, I originally wrote it like this, but we had to condense it down because we couldn't develop that story the rest of the way. And, man, I would buy a copy. I'm just saying, maybe two or three. So.
Yeah, make that two of us.
Yeah.
Well, I've presented it to Monty, but so far no takers. We'll see.
Well, we'll have to get a grassroots thing going on.
do you think Wizards of the Coast is completely done with Dragonlance, or do you think they'll ever revisit that?
I have no idea. I really don't. I don't know what their agenda is. I don't know. Wow. Like I say, they don't talk to me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Dragonlance was your first foray, as we just discussed, into the whole world creation and everything else. And it was the first book that really started going, and the first series that you and Tracy started working on. But you worked on dozens of books with him since. I think dozens might be an understatement. What was it about your working relationship with Tracy that really just clicked and created such great things?
Well, he's an amazingly creative person. It was just fun working with him. I've written novels by myself, like Star of the Guardians, and I've written with a co-author, and there are really good, really advantages to both. I mean, I love having a co-author that I can bounce ideas off of, and I get the characters into a whole lot of trouble, and then I call Tracy and I say, you know, look, this is Hasselhoff's going to die unless you can figure out. Tracy always did, you know. I mean, so one of my favorites. we were writing Legends, and again, writing for TSR with the last book in Legends, we were on this horrible deadline. I mean, I think we had a month to write that book. It was ridiculous.
Oh, gee.
So I realized coming up to the end that, you know, Caramon is supposed to go into the abyss, and suddenly I realized that here Raceland had to go through three books of torment to be able to get into the abyss, you know, getting Crisania and all this complicated stuff. And here, what was Caramon going to do? Just walk right in? And so I called Tracy, and it was like, what, it's been about 10 o'clock at night. I'm going, Tracy, this makes no sense. We can't do this. What are we going to do? And he said, well, Caramon has one thing that nobody knows about. And I said, yeah, I'm writing notes. And he said, Caramon always carried American Express.
Oh, my gosh.
He gets into the abyss with his American Express card. I know. So, that's what makes it a lot of fun.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a good working relationship. I wish me and Kent had a working relationship like that.
Right. Oh, geez.
Ours is more like, hey, man, I got an idea. And he's like, hey, man, here's another idea to add to that. And then we just end up, we have a 7 foot tall pile of ideas, but no actual execution. We need an executor for our ideas. Right. We have all the creativity. We have none of the transition to actual product.
I think this podcast is about the only thing we've successfully pulled off together.
There's been a few road trips, you know, that we made it through South by, and, you know.
That's true. That is true.
We're not completely fruitless, but nowhere near the success of Margaret Weiss and Tracy.
So Margaret, you've worked with a few other authors as well on projects. Is it the same as working with Tracy? Like, as far as like Tracy created the world and you wrote the stories, is it a similar relationship with the other co-authors?
Well, it's different with different authors. Like my daughter and I wrote two paranormal romances, and that was a lot of fun. We used to go to a Japanese restaurant and get a bottle of sake and work out the plot and write it down on napkins. And
nice.
Wrote all the sex scenes. And, which she said was really embarrassing. I never occurred to me, you know, but she said that was really hard because as she's writing, she's going, oh my God, my mother's going to be reading this.
Right. I can imagine. Oh man.
It's one of those, I'm not going to ask you how you relate to this. I'm just going to put it in the book and move on.
Right. Yeah. Oh, wow.
And so then my current co-author, I'm working with Robert Kramus on the Dragon Brigade series. And again, we work on the plot together, and he does a lot of the world design, and he's kind of my military advisor. And then we do a lot of texting back and forth, which, of course, Tracy and I didn't do because there was no such thing back in those days.
Right.
So we text and email, and so that's good.
Very cool.
So how hard is it for you to kill off a character? Like how hard is it to actually write their death? Does it affect you personally or?
Yes. I mean, I always say I wrote the death of Sturm because I worked at night and I was inputting the book at TSR. So I was working on their mainframe computer and I had Keith Parkinson, I think it's Keith Parkinson, picture of Sturm facing the dragon standing on the wall of the Fire Tower. And And I started writing that scene, and I wrote those last three words, Sturm's son shattered. And to this day, I can't talk about it. I start crying, and I had to quit the night. I was crying so hard, I couldn't see the computer screen. And then of course, I had to go through the funeral and everything, and I cried all the way through that. And Tracy cried. I gave it to him to read the next day, and he cried. There in his cubicle at work. So, yeah, it really does. I mean, you live with these characters. They become, you know, as close to you as friends and family.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's very hard to see them die.
Yeah, because I know for me as a reader, like, because I was at a very vulnerable age, I guess, when I was reading these books, and I didn't have a whole lot of friends, and the companions were my friends. And I mean, I knew they were fiction, but I felt on some level that they were real, and they mattered. They mattered to me. And to read their deaths or any bad things happening to them, it affected me. The one that affected me the most, I think, was Flint's death. And I remember actually crying when I read that. And I think one of the reasons that affected me so much is because the interactions between Flint and Tasselhoff was so endearing to me. And I felt like I identified a lot with Tasselhoff, and I absolutely loved his relationship with Flint. And the way Tasselhoff reacted to Flint's death really, really like hit me hard.
Mm-hmm.
That was go ahead, ma'am.
Flint, you know, Sturm had been going to die from the beginning. But Flint, we didn't really know about until we got to that third book. And then Tracy said that, you know, we had all these heroic deaths, you know, but that we should see a character who died a natural death after having lived a very long and good life. And so that's how Flint death came about.
Hmm.
See, that particular moment, I don't know if I shared this on the air or not, but I had a classmate that I looked over and he was reading that book and he had tears in his eyes. And I was like, what? Are you okay? You know? And he was like, no, I'm just reading this book. It's just amazing. And he started telling me about the book and I was like, well, I've got to read this book. This sounds exactly like something that I should grab a hold of. And he was like, well, it's the third one, so you need to find the first one. Going to the library to find that first one, finding out that Patrick Midiff actually had it checked out, or Jeremy Dillon, or, you know, whoever it was, tracing those books out and trying to find who had them and who had read what and talking to people about those books actually developed the friendship me and Kent have, the friendship that we have with a couple of our friends back home in Indiana that lives on to this day. And it's weird that we can all trace back to that point, because we're all about the same age. We can all trace back to that point where we started to discover who we were and where we wanted to be in life. And I know it's probably part of the age, but a lot of it has to do with just the kinship that those books brought us.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
So,
that's fun.
Which is funny because me and Gordon Jackson haven't talked since high school. You know, the catalyst to convincing me to read the books that a couple of the other guys had told me to read. So, whatever. He used to work out. I'm sure he's doing fine. Right.
Right.
You said, you know, the paintings of Sturm looking at the dragon and everything else. And I brought it up on Google real quick and I'm looking at the artwork and I actually have, you know, the art of the Dragonlance saga. It's got so many gorgeous pictures in there. When you're writing these books and you see this amazing art that, you know, Larry Elmore and Caldwell and all them are making for what you're writing, one, how does that affect you personally, knowing that they're creating such works of art out of what you've written? And two, how does it affect what you write in the future? Does it help you visualize your own vision when you're writing?
I tell you, working with those guys was an amazing experience. They were so much fun to work with, and they were so talented. By the time I got there, most of the 12 paintings for the modules were already done, which is how I knew what Raceland looked like. And I based my descriptions of the character off of their artwork. In later years, Larry and Keith both did cover paintings for us when we moved to Bantam. And, it was, you know, we would get together and talk about, and say, like funny story about Larry. He lived in the area. We all lived in the same area then. We were working on the Dark Sword trilogy, which we had sold to Bantam. And, so I was talking to Larry and about what the hero looked like. And I happened to see this guy in Lake Geneva who looked exactly like what I imagined Joram to look like. And I told Larry, and Larry said, I have seen that same guy. So, but we didn't know who he was. So I was out one day with my son and I saw him again and I pointed him out and David said, ah, I know who he is. And so he gave us the name and I told Larry and Larry said, well, what am I going to do? I can't call him up and ask him to model for me. He'll think I'm weird. So he tried to get his wife to do it. And Betty said, no, no way. And so finally my son said, okay, I'll get this guy. Well, it turned out he was a male stripper.
And oh my gosh.
But I tell you, he was good looking. Oh my gosh. But this guy in the world. I mean, talk about your dumb blonde. But he did. He modeled for us. And so we got him. So if you look at the cover on the Dark Sword painting, that is the guy.
Oh wow. That's an amazing story.
That is beautiful. See, things like that, I you know, the serendipity of situations like that that just happened to come across, it blows me away. All right. We did, before, you know, because we don't want to eat up too much of your time today, we did put out there on the Reddit and we got some questions on that. So I'd like to go ahead and address those real quick.
Sure.
Jeff Leosaurus, says, what were your thoughts on the War of Souls? I felt the story started off strong, but lost its way by the second and then ended on a flat note. Was it creative differences, loss of interest, or am I just being an ass? Either way, thanks for all the advice.
You know, that was kind of a difficult situation because there'd been that whole fifth phase thing, which we weren't involved in, and the PSR had gone bankrupt, and then Peter Atkinson asked us to come back, and because there were two Dragonlance factions, and we had to bring them together, and so, you know, Tracy came up with, I just thought was a brilliant idea for to keep us stealing the world away, and we kind of went from there.
You see, I of course with the fifth age, they brought out the new way of playing the game, and I don't know, I didn't quite jive with it, but I thought the War of Souls was a great way of taking where it had gone and bringing it back into the fold of what I knew and what I loved and what I was comfortable with. So I actually thought, you know, they were a great, is a masterful patch to a gaping hole in my idea of Kryn. So I don't know.
Yeah, because Tracy and I, when we wrote Summer Flame, we had been going to take it in a whole different direction. But then we were told, no, thank you. The fifth age team is going to take over. And so we were busy with other stuff at the time. I think we were doing Death Gate or something like that. And we said, okay, fine. Yeah. You have our blessing. Go forth.
Yeah, that was... so I thought War of Souls was great because it brought it back to, you know, to what I knew and what I was comfortable with. So that's just me. Okay. Yeah. We have Cat for Hire. Like, I don't know where these people come up with these names. I mean, I know where Ethan Cain came from. Ethan Cain was my name when we used to play Vampire the Masquerade. That was my vampire's name, and that's where Del Noche came from for you. So right, I know right. where we came up with ours, but I don't think anybody's going to – I don't know. I don't see a D&D character named Cat for Hire, so I'm just wondering how. I'm assuming it's a she. I don't know.
I would say so because she starts out by saying, "I'm fangirling so hard right now."
See, there you go. That's all the details. Weiss is the reason I decided to become a writer in the first place. In the ripe old age of 12, when I picked up my first copy of Dragonlance, I have since been working on that dream. I love the Ashes trilogy that with Mina and the gods featured. Where did the idea for that come about, and how much fun was it to write?
Oh, that was War of Souls. Yeah. So, you know, then of course I did the spinoff trilogy with Mina, which was cool too. It was a lot of fun. Mina came about because I wanted a character who was a dark Joan of Arc. And I even did research on Joan of Arc when I was working on Mina. And, so that's where she came from.
Yeah. I again, that whole thing, I thought it was great. So, the Sovereign Stone trilogy was, in my humble opinion, a masterpiece. What was the drafting process like?
Oh, Larry Elmore came up with the world for Sovereign Stone. We had a big meeting at my house. Larry was here and, a bunch of us and, basically, with Sovereign Stone, we wanted a world where that had dwarves and elves, but they weren't your typical dwarves and elves. So we made the elves more of a Japanese-based culture and made the dwarves like pony-riding, barbarian nomads, you know, so that was a lot of fun.
So basically, Larry wanted something really cool to draw.
Yes, absolutely.
It keeps coming back to that.
Right.
let's see. And she finishes up with, I would like to know how one works with another author in writing a book. I often have trouble knowing my own mind, much less bringing my mind to work collaboratively with someone else's.
Well, like I've said, it's different with different authors, but I think the most important thing is respect. You know, respect each other's ideas and opinions, even if you don't agree with them. And oftentimes you'll find in compromise that you come up with something better than either you thought about.
Excellent. That actually sounds pretty on par with projects I've worked on.
Okay. Real Star Player says, "Hi, Margaret. I'm a big fan. I was wondering, how was your experience working with TSR? Were they helpful or a hindrance when it came to publishing your stories?"
Yeah. That's kind of a heavy hitting question there.
At the time, TSR was in chaos. We pretty much never knew from one week to the next if we were going to have jobs. Like I say, Random House had told them the book wasn't going to sell. They managed to fire most of the marketing department before it came out. So Tracy and I were left doing our own marketing. It was a very chaotic time, but it was a lot of fun. I mean, I made friends at TSR that I've kept for a lifetime. So it was more by happenstance, I think, that the book came out than really it was planned. But wow. It came out and the fans were so receptive, and it made the New York Times bestseller list. So it was as a write-in candidate. So that was pretty awesome.
Right. Awesome.
That's
Patrick.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Patrick wanted to know, what do you think?
Patrick from our youth, the Patrick we were just mentioning a few minutes ago, he had a few questions for you himself. So.
Yeah, I think most of it's been answered already, but this one hasn't been addressed. He wants to know what you think of Ravenloft and specifically the Lord Soth stories.
Oh, I hated it. I mean, I loved Ravenloft. I think the original Tracy and Laura Hickman Ravenloft was probably the best RPG module ever written. I mean, it was amazing. I actually played Tafelhoff in Ravenloft with Tracy as the DM. It was so much fun. But then the whole business of taking word thoughts to Ravenloft, and in fact, at a, I was a celebrity guest player at a con once, and I actually played Kitiara leading a group of adventurers to Ravenloft to rescue Soth and bring him back.
Wow. Yeah. It always seemed to me that Soth got unceremoniously dumped off in Ravenloft, even though Ravenloft is an amazing area. And he seemed, you know, his character really seemed to fit there. It just, it seemed off. It never quite fit for me.
Yeah, I felt the same.
No, and they were, you know, they were trying to bring Kryn fans into Ravenloft, was what they were trying to do. And it was so blatantly obvious that everybody was like, seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right about Ravenloft. I haven't read another, you know, because I've read all through the Talladus stuff and, you know, Greyhawk and several other fantasy genres and settings, and nowhere else other than Ravenloft did it give me a litmus test for the kind of person that needed to be there to DM for that, you know, for that setting. Like, anybody can just jump into Kryn if you know some knowledge and you can play it and you can just follow the rules, and there's already such a rich story there and such a rich history and everything's already laid out for you. It's pretty easy. You can go into, you know, Greyhawk, and of course that's El Generic, you know, and you just create something and off you go. But for Ravenloft, like, I hear people running a Ravenloft campaign and I'm like, whoa, you know, what kind of DM you got? Because I'm not playing with just random Joe. You know, Ravenloft, just this setting deserves a certain amount of respect just from the way that it was written and presented. And, you know, the feel of the world is just, it's so different than most other things.
Yeah, I agree totally on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so our friend Jeremy says, thank you for creating such a great world and such great characters and such strong female characters. Lorana is one of my favorite female characters, and he points out that his six-year-old daughter is named Lorana after your character.
Oh, that's cool. I met Lorana's. I met Teacher. I met several Raistlin.
You've actually, somebody's named their child Raistlin?
Oh, yeah, many.
Oh, my gosh.
At one time, I was at a convention, and a guy came up to me and said he was responsible. He was like the person in Florida who was in charge of a list of names, collecting baby names of all the kids born. And he started seeing this name, Raistlin, popped up, and he couldn't figure out where it came from. And somebody told him that it came from the Dragonlance novels. And he actually had come. He wasn't a fan. He just had come to this convention to meet me and to tell me about it. So, yeah, I mean.
Oh, my goodness.
And tells about, she was in a petting zoo once, and she heard this mother going, Raistlin, Raistlin, you leave that goat alone. No.
Wow. That's okay. So, Sarithia, I'm talking to you right now. This is why we can't have a boy, because he will be named Raistlin. End of story. I now have validation. This is why we cannot have a boy. Wow.
I've been a girl's named Raistlin.
Wow.
One girl. They spelled it Raistlin.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I've always given Jeremy some crap because he named his daughter Lorana, but he didn't go the full-fledged, you know, Lorana and Thalissa. So it's just me, though. If you're going to go all out.
I had trouble learning to spell Margaret. I mean, I can't imagine.
Good point. In third grade, I walked into class, and I couldn't find Tony Lemos anywhere on any of the desks because they were all labeled. And I kept walking around. There's only one desk empty, and the name on there was Anthony Lemos. And I was like, who's this Anthony kid? Why has he got my last name? And where's my chair? You know, I'd never heard my name is Anthony, so I can't, you know, I can only imagine. Third grade, I got like four more letters in my name. I was pissed. Oh, man.
So my girlfriend Stephanie wants to know, when you were a little girl, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be an artist.
How did you come about becoming a writer?
Well, I was always a storyteller. When I was in kindergarten, my teacher used to put me up in front of the class, and I would tell stories to the kids during, you know, rest time. So I was just always a storyteller, and I could always write. But it never occurred to me that I should be able, that I could do that for a living. So I wanted to be an artist. And I was actually majoring in art in university my first year, freshman year. And my freshman English teacher took me to one side. She had me stay after class, which freaked me out. You know, you're a freshman in college. You flash back to high school, going to the principal's office. I couldn't figure out what I'd done wrong. So she kept me after class, and she said, I just wanted to tell you that you have a gift as a writer. And if you have never thought about majoring in creative writing in English, I would suggest you do that. And I often say that it was like the movie, The Blues Brothers, where the heavens open up and the sun shines down on John Belushi and he knows he has to put the band back together.
Yeah.
That moment, I knew that was what I was meant to do. And that day, I switched my major from art to English.
Wow.
Very cool.
So
I'm still waiting on that moment in my life.
Oh, I've had that moment. This is what I've determined to do. I've got so many ideas for podcasts. This is it. This is what I want to do when I grow up. So never mind the fact that I'm hitting 40 in like a year and a half, but whatever. This is what I want to do when I grow up. This has been so much fun. Well, we're at about an hour on the phone with you, Margaret, and I know we promised you we wouldn't take up your entire morning. So, I'd like to turn it over to you and ask, what are you working on? What would you like to push out there, and what should we be expecting from you in the near and distant future? What do you got? We were fans, and we want to see what you have available to us. What's going on?
Okay, the fourth and last Dragon Ship book that Tracy and I wrote is coming out in January 1916. That's Doom of the Dragon. Right now I'm working on the first novel in a sequel series to the Dragon Brigade. It's called Dragon Corsairs. The first novel is Spymaster. And that and Flyball Racing is pretty much what I'm doing.
Sounds awesome. And you said you will be at Dragon Con as a fan this year.
Yes.
So
I'll be on some panels, and I've got an autograph session. So bring your books for me to sign and stop by and say hi.
Wow, that is awesome. I had a question and it just disappeared. Man, it's such a great closing.
Is there anything new on the horizon for Margaret Weiss Productions?
We're still working on Firefly, and we have some ideas on some new projects, but we can't really talk about them at the moment.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so Firefly, we have to ask about that. Were you a fan of the original series? Are you a fan of it? Were you a fan of Serenity?
Absolutely.
Where are you at with that?
I was a fan from the very beginning. A friend of mine actually got a bootleg copy of the pilot at Dragon Con, as a matter of fact. And so I had to watch it in order because I saw the pilot first. And I was a huge fan from that point on.
Awesome. And now you guys are making the RPG, releasing modules. You got the books out and everything else. I think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
That's another setting that I've actually played. And you really... Okay, so in Ravenloft, you have to have a GM that can really handle the descriptions and handle the turmoil and relay that sense of angst and of
fear and foreboding.
Yeah, exactly. The world lives, you know, and... I've found that with Firefly, you really have to have players that understand that it's different than other places, not just as a setting, but as a personal environment that you're bringing something to the game that's different than just rolling some dice and, you know, continuing the story. You have to develop the story as a player, not just as a character.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it fun. It's very much about the storytelling and the role playing.
It's really wonderful. So, let's get a quick view down of our list. Did we miss anything, Kent? Is there anything that we're lacking?
I don't think. Well, one more quick question about about Margaret Weiss Productions. How much hands-on do you actually have with
development of the games?
Well, I was involved back in the day when we were first coming up with the Cortex system. And then I wrote an adventure for Firefly, which was a lot of fun, called The Wedding Planner. And came up with another idea for another adventure. But basically, I have a really good crew who handles like the nuts and bolts stuff, because my love is writing. I mean, that's what I do. And I have four dogs to support. So, you know, I need to concentrate on the writing.
Wow.
Very cool.
I just have one. My wife hates him, but, well, she doesn't like dogs. She doesn't like animals. But she let me get Sam, and today's the 27th. Well, it's coming up. Yeah, it's 27th for me now. He turns 1 year old tomorrow, and he already outweighs almost every kid in the house. So he's a pureblood German Shepherd, but he's not the white. He's a blonde. So he's got the shadings of a German Shepherd, but it's just different shades of light yellow, and he's gorgeous. And he sits there, and he'll be a pillow to the kids and everything else. And he's just a great dog. So I'm so glad to finally have another dog in my life. I haven't had a dog since since I got divorced several years ago. I guess before then, I shouldn't call the ex-wife a dog. Like, that came out the totally wrong way, but it reflects. So, I don't see anything else that we're majorly missing. Is there, is there anything else that you would like to tell people about before we let you go, ma'am?
No, not really. So it's been fun. Thanks for having me on.
It's been an amazing conversation. I'm so glad we made this happen again. We're totally fanboying right now. we started this podcast hoping to get talent like you, people that have actually affected our lives, and be able to talk to you and have this as a platform, not only to share with us, but also with our listeners and watchers. So it's been amazing having you on.
Oh, well, yes, thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh yeah. It's, I've actually recently stopped drinking, which is weird for people in Korea. So, It's just an awful side note, but it's been a major difference in just my quality of life over here. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah, interesting. What do you think about that, Kent? I haven't had a drink in over 2 weeks here in Korea.
That's it's impressive.
I'm sure it won't last. Man, we appreciate you so much for coming on and for responding to our emails and answering the questions, even though you probably answered all of them at one time or another. Great conversation, and is good to hear you and have you laugh along with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for asking me.
Let's see. I was going to close the show out, but I didn't have the right page open and I don't remember my script. Ma'am, this is why we're in beta. This right here. This is why we're in beta. We are never leaving beta, because that always gives us an excuse when we don't have the right page open. So, All right. For those of you watching and listening, if you want to support this podcast, just cruise on over to ritualmisery.com, click on the Amazon link. Anything that you buy, they kick us back a little bit, and it helps us out a little bit. Every little bit helps, and we appreciate that a lot. We'll give a special thank you to our guest, Margaret Weiss. It's been amazing, as I've just said. Thank you so much for coming on. If you are interested in following Margaret on her path through life, you can find her at Weiss Margaret on Twitter. She's also on the Facebook if you want to look her up. Kent, where can people find you, man?
You can follow me on Twitter at @RM_DelNoche. If you are a beer guy like me, go over to ratebeer.com and look for username Del Noche.
Very cool. I'm Amos at Ethan Kane on the Twitter. You can follow the show on Twitter at Ritual Misery. Submit ideas to our subreddit, ritualmisery.reddit.com. You can email us, podcast@ritualmisery.com. Call and leave us a voicemail, 567-69-TRMPC. That's 567-698-7672. 567-698-7672. Of course, you can find all these links and more ways to support the show and give feedback at our website, ritualmisery.com. Thank you so much to Kevin McLeod for allowing us to use your music. Thank you for listening or watching. For Kent, for Margaret, for me, and for you, this has been your Ritual Misery Podcast.
See ya.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this